Well, good evening to all of you. Welcome to our service tonight. We'll start our service with two songs, at least if we have a song leader. Okay, come on.
Give to our God a
He leads me to
this evening with the topic that Benji will be looking at for us, Lessons from the Life of William Carey. I thought I'd read what is known as the Great Commission, and that is Matthew 28, starting in verse 16. Matthew 28, verse 16. Then the 11 disciples went away into Galilee to the mountain which Jesus had appointed for them. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the ends of the age. Amen." I think this will be an interesting evening for us, considering the fact that, and I don't want to take anything away from Benji here, but that William Carey was a missionary in India. I think our church has a lot of interest in what's happening over there right now. So look forward to the evening with see what Benji has to share. Let's take your prayer requests at this time. Okay, if that's all, we'll turn the time over to Benji as he presents us with the lessons from the life of William Carey.
I'm going to start by talking a little bit, probably the first half, I'm going to be talking about the life and the events and the series, the series of events in his life. And then after that, there's about three or four different things I would like to discuss, kind of address, and then hopefully receive feedback from you as we kind of try to apply some of the apply lessons from his life. William Carey is known by many as the father of modern missions. Men like David Livingstone, C.T. Studd, and others followed after him. And prior to his time, there wasn't a lot of Protestant missions going out from either Europe or North America. And he was kind of considered the forerunner to modern missions as we know it today. He was a poor young boy who supposedly wasn't smart enough to finish school. So he got a trade as a cobbler, and he started as an apprentice, and carried that on through. However, he was a master linguist. He just picked up languages extremely quickly, and by the end of his life, he had translated the Bible or parts of the Bible into 30 different languages, over 30 different languages. Botany was another subject that he seemed to master. There's a marble bust of him. In the home of the Horticulture Society in Calcutta, and he was elected a member of the Horticulture Society in London and the Geological Society of England. He also preached throughout his time as a missionary, but that was never his strength. He was in India for a total of 42 years and without a break until he died in 1834. He was born August 17, 1761, in Northampton, England. And like I said, he grew up, became a cobbler, and when he was 18, he attended a life-changing prayer meeting. And part of what was shared was Hebrews 13:3, and there it said, "Let us therefore go out unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach." Let us go out unto him without the camp, bearing his reproach. The idea occurred to him that perhaps the Church of England was the established camp, since it was enforced by law. Carey journaled, "I concluded that all that were in the camp were protected from the scandal of the cross, and I ought to bear the reproach of Christ among dissenters or those outside of the church." And so that was kind of the beginning of Carey's pursuit of spirituality outside of established religion during that day. And he became a member of the Baptists and kind of began to move out of a lot of the kind of the dead Anglican church that was present in England at the time. In 1781, he was married to Dorothy Plackett. It was probably an arranged marriage. In 1783, he became convinced by a Baptist preacher that he needed to be baptized. Carey was probably baptized in an infant, so his second baptism made him an Anabaptist, or a rebaptizer. In 1792, he published a pamphlet called An Inquiry. The pamphlet was like, it had a longer name. It was like, well, I forget it. It's really long. It was a really, really good piece of work, and it was distributed throughout England and moved a lot of people and kind of was the beginning again of a heart for missions among the churches in England. It was over this time that Carey began to increasingly go public with his vision for reaching out and reaching to the heathen. And so one time he was in a meeting, and it was like a prayer meeting or something like that, and he wondered if they should consider whether the command given to the apostles, is what Larry shared with us, to teach all nations was not binding on all succeeding ministers to the end of the world, seeing the accompanying promise was of equal extent. Basically, he's saying, you know, the command was to the end of the world, the promise was to the end of the world, why aren't we doing it today? His suggestion was met with a harsh rebuke. An older man stood up, he said, "Young man, sit down. You are an enthusiast. When God pleases to converse with the heathen, he'll do it without consulting you or me. Besides, there must be another Pentecostal gift of tongues." So he wasn't very well received. His ideas of proselytizing, evangelizing among the heathen. In 1793, he was commissioned to go to India. He said he would go if those behind would hold the ropes. And back in those days, it won't surprise you, but they would have wells. And there was no cover on the wells, obviously. And sometimes small children like you would fall down into the wells. And then, so they needed to get them out, obviously. And so they would, somebody would volunteer to go down into the well, and they would tie a rope around the ankle. And while he was lowered down, however many men would hold back and hold the ropes and let him down to rescue somebody who was dying down there. And so this is what Carey was talking about. He said, "I'm going to India. I'm going to go save people. Or I want to try to save people. But you back here in England need to hold the ropes and support me." And that's what they did as long as they were alive. There's three men in particular who made sure that there was always support. It ran thin a couple times and things like that. But there was always support there for Carey. And I think that's important. I think we do well. I think we do well as I guess Christendom at large, but at least from what I've seen of this church, in supporting missionaries and not letting go of the rope. At this time, when he was commissioned to go to India, his wife Dorothy was pregnant, expecting within a few months, and had no interest whatsoever in moving to India. She had never seen the sea, wanted to stay near her mother, and didn't even want Carey to go. William knew better than to yield to her reservations, and consoled himself with a passage: "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He journaled that. He said, "This is why I can't let my wife's objections get in the way." He said resolutely, "I must part with a beloved family. I have set my hand to the plow." Such dedication. He was willing to leave his wife and three young sons behind in England while he embarked on an 8-month journey around the world with no promise of ever returning. He set out, but he was delayed a little bit at the Isle of Wight, which is just off the coast of England. So he's basically still in England. There he heard of his son's birth, and his wife named him Jabez. And you probably, most of you probably know what that means, but it means born out of my sorrow. And so she wasn't doing that hot these days. Carey was delayed and eventually needed to arrange another way of getting to India. So he went actually back to the mainland, and he really wanted his wife and family to come along. But with a baby under a month old, and three boys under 9, she thought it was preposterous. See, I think Brenda just had a son. And so imagine Arlen stands up in church and he says, "We're going to India." And of course, keep in mind that transportation isn't nearly as nice these days. And they have this boy who's, you know, less than a month old. And so how many of you would like have a word with Arlen before he does that? So this is what's happening. You know, this is life. This is what's happening. And I'd like to discuss it a little bit more with you all. Finally, Carrie was able to persuade her to come along, with the promise of that her sister Kitty, his wife's sister, Dorothy's sister Kitty, would join them. In November of 1793, they finally arrived in Calcutta. Dorothy immediately took a disliking to the place. She didn't like the weather. It was like hot and humid, and there was like snakes and tigers and things like that. They couldn't get much food because they were poor, obviously, and she didn't even like the food. And Carrie wasn't really around much. She spent a lot of time moving around the villages. Something that's really interesting, and it was just recently pointed out to me, is that his wife was actually illiterate. And so he was moving around in the area, translating the Bible and working to learn the language and educating natives. And his wife at home was illiterate. And so it seems like he didn't have much of a heart to bring her along. So we have the situation. They're living there in India. She became feverish. Some mosquito bit her probably. And because of the enormous stress she was under, her son died. She snapped. Like, literally snapped. She went crazy. Like, loco. Like, yeah, whatever. She couldn't process things as an adult. 7 years later, after their arrival in Calcutta, Carrie baptized his first convert. So this is 7 years of work and work with the natives before his first convert came. And I think that's often the way it works, is it takes years before the first fruits really start to show up, especially when you're breaking ground into a new culture. In 1801, he completed a translation of the New Testament into Bengali. And in 1807, his wife, Dorothy Carey, finally died. In 1808, he noticed a wealthy, godly woman by the name of Charlotte. How much better can it get? He fell desperately in love with her and asked her to marry him. However, she was an invalid, and the missionaries he was there with didn't think it was a good idea. She always had to go around in a wheelchair, and they said she's gonna drag you down. You know, you won't be able to travel as much. But as people in this state of being often are, they were stubborn about it, and they got married. So he was married the second time. Carrie was overjoyed and called her his soulmate. In 1812, they had a printing shop established and were printing out New Testaments in tongues and translations that Carrie had done. In the shop he had books, like dictionaries that he had made, lots and lots of original linguistic work, and translations of the Bible, and the printing presses and all the blocks and the languages, all the letters and everything. And sometime in 1812, it burned to the ground. It burned for like 3 days, and everything was gone. They tried to salvage things, but it was they couldn't salvage anything. So the next morning, after everything was ash, at this point, I think I would have been heading to maybe like Tahiti and looking for a beach and was just to like recover and you know, meditate on something like the glory of God or something nice like that. But Carrie the next morning got up and started his translation work again, and it's incredible. And he was a plotter. Many people, like, that's kind of the description of him. He wasn't, he was brilliant in his own way, but it doesn't seem that he like had a particularly high IQ. However, he was a plotter and he worked and kept everything. Kept going even in the rough times, and I think that faithfulness is what made him or made his work great. Made him so usable. In 1821, his second wife died. He remarried a third time, 2 years later. And in June of 1834, he died. That's kind of an overview of his life. He was very respected at certain points for his proficiency with the language, and was honored by not only British officials, but also Indian officials. And he really moved around in society well, and was honored and used that to bring social change. And one of the things that he's famous for is abolishing the practice of wife burning. And basically, the practice is when a husband would die, sometimes his wife, their wives were burned with him to serve him in the afterlife. And that was something that it took years and years. I think like 20 or 30 years. Of Kerry moving around, pulling strings in politics to get this abolished. The first lesson to be learned, and this is kind of whatever, tongue-in-cheek, but don't do arranged marriages. It's a mistake. William and Dorothy were probably set up by well-meaning parents who thought they could work things out. But he was a master linguist with an enormous heart for nations beyond the dangerous horizons. She was illiterate, had never been to London, and didn't really care much for mission work. It's kind of an interesting story. A friend of mine in Thailand, his name was Pervez, he was from Pakistan but had to leave because he was facing persecution there. And he came into one of our classes at IGO and shared his story about his arranged marriage, and he came in and he said yeah, I was growing up, and he said my father started meeting with this other guy, and he got kind of suspicious, and sure enough they were making plans for him to get married, and he didn't want to get married, he wasn't ready to get married, he didn't feel like getting married, and he told his dad, he said I'm not going to get married, or I don't want to get married, and his dad said, yes, you have to submit, you have to be an example to your younger brothers and sisters. And this was a Christian family, by the way, and do that. And it's kind of funny because his dad said, look, here's a picture, and he showed him a picture. And I can still see Pervez. He's like, and I looked at the picture, and even that I didn't like. And so it was not love at first sight by any sense. Anyway, they finally got married, and it was kind of crazy because he got married, got married, and about 2 days later, he had to go back to finish up some responsibilities at his teaching position, and she stayed, I think, in his hometown area. So he was standing there by a table, and his cousin was standing beside him, and somebody came up to him and said, congratulations, you know, you're married, and you know, that's great, and he's like, and the friend across from the table was like, what's her name? And he's like, what's her name? And he completely forgot her name right there on the spot. And then I think it came to him like within, you know, five seconds or so, but it was pretty bad. Anyway. But today they couldn't be happier. It's a really, really sweet couple. And he's happy with her. And she was more than willing to follow him from Pakistan to Thailand with their young family. And so I guess it can work. In all seriousness, we can see how an ill-advised marriage can bring a lot of sorrow into somebody's life. The second related thing I would like to discuss a bit is his family situation, and kind of discussing what was Kerry thinking, and you know, was he doing the right thing? Was he too focused on spreading the gospel, or was he just simply misguided? as far as, you know, his relationship with his family and his care for his wife. Somebody recently said, family is the most serious obstacle to missions. And he continued to reason. He said, how many people have you heard who have, you know, have come home to be with family or to, you know, my kids, you know, need to go to school or whatever. And so this was a guy I was talking to. I don't necessarily agree with him. But, you know, he said, you know, how many people have you heard that happen? I also read somewhere that anyone who comes to Christ but refuses to hate his father, mother, spouse, brother, sisters, yes, even one's own self cannot be a disciple of Christ. Anyone who won't shoulder his own cross and follow behind Jesus can't be my disciple. And of course, this is Christ talking. And I'm pretty sure he was using hyperbole. But nevertheless, you know, this is the kind of the scripture that Carey used to justify himself. His wife was raving mad. She had to be locked up in a room, separate room, while he was doing ministry. And he resolutely kept his family in India in the face of her breakdown, feeling God's irresistible call to stay and minister. So what do you say? How sensitive are we to the needs of our family when they seem to conflict with the call of Christ? Or maybe will it conflict? Did Carey show too little care for his family? I just want to open it up for discussion. And I would really like to hear if anybody who's been on the mission field for more than a year, if you have any stories or any lessons, what can we learn as far as how is this whole work, the whole thing works together? Maybe there is no conflict. Maybe, yeah, I don't know. So I want to open it up to you all now. What questions or comments do you have? Paul. David. Lowell, I think, had his hand up. Thank you. Very good. Thank you. Jared, did you? Nathan and Hans.
Just obviously, William Carey was a arranged marriage. He didn't have a whole lot to say about that. But one thing looking at those kinds of people, I have to, given their weaknesses, so I wonder sometimes if we may fall too much on the other side. Take the verse you just quoted, his words there. Either for us to write it off symbolic and maybe not take it as seriously.
Thank you. Hans.
One missionary friend of mine who has been on the field quite a while told me that he, you know, a lot of people often think family conflicts with mission work, but it's been his experience that his family is his best tool on the mission field and that they open doors that wouldn't normally be open. Just interacting on a family-to-family basis, he found open a lot of doors. And I think that is God's plan, that, somehow family, it's not seen as mutually exclusive, where Carey had either his work or his family. I don't understand at all how that works together, but that's one testimony.
Yeah. Thank you. Grandpa, you can have the last word.
I think that wherever the heroes are, that we will notice that it's not to get they were human.
Right.
And I think there would have been some other scriptures that we could have considered.
Sure.
Like loving your wife as Christ loved the church and giving them some support.
Mm-hmm.
And providing them a household, see that some do that is that united the faith and the person in him for them. So I think it's important that you try to consider all the scriptures on a given subject and remember all the heroes, great heroes of the world, were human too. They had their
own. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for the discussion. This is some good stuff. I really like what Lowell brought out, and this is kind of about how that people moved when there was persecution to protect themselves, protect their families. And I think it was something that was well and right. And it was something that God used in a very powerful way to spread the church. And that's very valid. Like what Hans said, especially, also, the family can be a good tool on the mission field. And that's not something to neglect. And finally, I guess I have to concur with what David David Yoder said about, you know, maybe some situations are best suited for singlehood. I mean, I think we would all agree. And so I guess finding Christ's plan for you and all of that is kind of the simple answer to all these questions. Something else I'd kind of like to discuss a little bit is the fact that William Carey was a revolutionary and kind of threw off the establishment, moved on with greater liberty and spirit-filled living. And there's kind of two ways to pursue or to assess people like that. And there are two different people who reject tradition and look for a better way to live or look for something that's different than what their church has given them or their family has given them or whatever their culture has given them. And I guess the first way that people go about this, about going about change, is that they become arrogant or they rebel for the sake of rebelling and kind of despise their heritage, things like that. An example would be maybe there's somebody called Levi Troyer in Indiana or Iowa or something, and he's Amish. And one day he wakes up and he realizes that there's all these rules that we follow, unwritten rules, whatever, are not represented by verses in the Bible. So he leaves the church, moves away from home, he buys a car, he buys an expensive truck, he joins some liberal Mennonite church and buys all the shicky shirts he can, and he gets this massive flat screen TV, and he is just so happy in his liberty. And every day after work, he sits down in front of the screen, and he sits there and he watches movies as if he's making up for lost time when he was Amish. And he says, "Man, I'm so glad I'm not legalistic anymore." And obviously, there's something wrong with this picture. And I think there's something distinctly different from another kind of revolutionary or another kind of somebody who's looking for something better. And that is that maybe Carey was moving on to greater spirituality, more dedication to Christ, and I guess most importantly, a fuller embrace of the cross and the suffering that came along with that, and I guess ultimately a better living out of the heart of God for his people. Jesus challenged establishment, but he didn't do it for like the sake of his own personal liberty or for whatever desires he had to satisfy himself. It wasn't for those purposes. And I think it's pretty obvious, at least from my standpoint, that Carey's separation from the Church of England was with the correct motives, because that move kind of left a lot of comfort, and he embraced a lot of suffering because of his move away from that, because he believed that God was calling him to mission work. And also, I think comparing his life to Scripture, I think we can see that his move away from the church he was born into was something that's positive. And I don't want this to focus too much on churches or moving away from churches, but I think you can kind of look at this from all different areas of life. So I'd like to discuss this a little bit. Somebody recently, I read an article recently that said prayer is the rebellion against the status quo. And what he meant by that was that the established order of this world is basically disorder. In other words, Satan is here to kill, destroy, steal, and maybe lie. Yeah, lie goes in there somewhere. And he's kind of the lord of this age. And when things are left to themselves, when God's power is absent, everything kind of degenerates into chaos, sickness. There's all sorts of evil things that happen. And so prayer is the deliberate choice to rebel against that, to go against what is natural or where this world is heading or where the momentum is going. So it's saying, when I pray for somebody sick, I'm praying against the consequences of sin. I'm asking God's power to come in and step in and intervene and bring his kingdom to earth, as it were, or the kingdom of heaven to earth. Or when I'm, you know, praying for someone who's considering a divorce, I'm praying that God would come in, repair their marriage, and restore, I guess, a bit of God's power, a bit of heaven back into earth. And so, and again, it's a rebellion, or it's kind of a something that's against what is natural. And so I guess kind of I throw that in to kind of balance everything out and thinking about how do we stand up, or how do we be different? How do we forge something that's new, that's better than our society teaches us, that our flesh teaches us, whatever. I guess I'm looking for some ways that we can apply it now. But I guess also, if you have any further thoughts on the analogy of something new, something better, or maybe even some cautions, I'd like to open it up now. Absolutely, and our focus has to be Christ. And whenever we focus on or focus backwards, then we're going to go astray. But I guess I would like to hypothesize that growth is, in a way, it's change, and it's maturity is change in some ways. It's moving on. Maybe I wasn't quite clear.
What I'm saying is that on the one side we might fall in the ditch by just pursuing something because it's new, and on the other side we might fall in the ditch that says I'm against change. And I think healthy change is that which is, like you say, growth or scriptural practice. Mm-hmm. And when Carrie was responding to the life that was given with regard to moving out to follow God's evangelization, that was scriptural change.
Right. Right. Grandpa.
I'm reminded of 1 Corinthians 15:58. The first part of it said it sounds like he's steadfast and unmovable, but it doesn't stop. There's always a valley in the work of the Lord. So doing things the same way we've done that doesn't mean that it's
Joel.
I'm wondering if one distinction may be the difference between starting with what should be versus starting with what is and how it should change.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if you start with what should be, well, then the direction for what is,
and
how it needs to move. Carrie's case fairly dramatically becomes apparent. Or if it is where it should be, then great.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I think that's good. Because obviously, we all know this. When we start focusing on what is or what has been, and base our actions or our reactions off of that, then it leads to sorrow and heresy and things like that. Paul. And I mean, the reason I'm bringing this up is because I know I like to be comfortable. When something's brought up at home that we need to change something, like where we sit at the table, you know, it's a little thing. But I kind of, you know, I'd rather just keep sitting where I was. And it's kind of a bummer because when I came back from Igo, my seat changed. And, Hans was pretty sure it was his all along, but... But what I'm saying is, and I'm talking about, I guess just built following Christ more perfectly, and does it, you know, maybe it means changing my lifestyle, maybe it means working less and spending time with my brother more, brothers in a church setting, you know what. It feels to me that growth and maturity is going to mean a change in our lifestyle. And I'm not talking about, you know, rejecting Anabaptist heritage. I'm not talking about going liberal, as it were, but rather having a maturity or having a greater maturity and just having a more pure focus on Christ. Anything else? Okay. One more thing, final thing. I'd like to read 1 Corinthians 2:2. Paul says, "For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified." That is what it's all about. It means that we never, ever let anything steal passion from Christ. Not cars, not money, not sports, not mission work, not the care of your family, not your wife, not your best friend. There are two John Millers that go to this church, and I like both of them pretty good. One of them I maybe like a little bit more than, and I'll let you guess maybe which one of that is. But anyway, we're really good friends. But if I let that friendship become anything more or anything less than a way to move to Christ and to glorify Him more, then something has to change, something new. I have to refine that. I have something has to go. In other words, you know, that's just everything. All our focus needs to be on Christ. All things, good, bad, or indifferent, have the potential to rob God of our devotion. It's all about Christ. How many times have you received a note or a card and it says, "Keep Jesus number one," or "Keep focusing on Him," or something like that? And I've gotten quite a few of those. Or like on the back of a picture, you know, somebody hands it to you. "Keep Jesus number one," or something like that. And to be honest, I think it's kind of lost its meaning for me. But it's good. It's great. I mean, that's like the gospel. That's awesome. It's so true. So next time you read that, think of that, because that's it. That's where it's at. That's the best thing they could wish for you. It's all about Christ. Everything about everything that's meaningful to us. Christ and His cross. "For I am determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified." We have nothing without it, and with it we have everything. It is our salvation to save us, and our all in all to sustain us. It is the gospel. You never, 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 never outgrow your need for the gospel. It's not about you, it's about Jesus. When Carrie was dying, there was a particular young man who interviewed Carrie. The young man, Alexander Duff, was extremely interested in Carrie's achievements. He gave liberal praise to the old man for his accomplishments. Carrie finally grew tired of the young man's adoration and said, "Mr. Duff, you have been speaking about Dr. Carey, Dr. Carey. When I am gone, say nothing of Dr. Carey, but speak about Dr. Carey's Savior." Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the challenge, Bendy. And maybe we can have another song, and then Marvin Mass, would you lead our prayer for us as we stand there?